in the 19th century, Cleopatra, sort of, as far as painter's concerned, becomes a sort of Turkish dancing girl. But anyway, so that's the beginning of her story, the story of her love affair with Julius Caesar. And although it's on a very small scale, it's the first that we know of Cleopatra's great sort of staged events. And she managed to get herself to Caesar's notice. It worked. Not only did they become lovers, perhaps more importantly to Cleopatra, he became her ally. He put her back on the throne and supported her in her conflict with her brother and the rival party. And then the second of Cleopatra's great staged events that we know about is one with which I'm sure you're all familiar, because it's the great speech in Shakespeare's play about, given by Ina Barbus, the description of Cleopatra arriving on the River Cydnus in her golden barge. Shakespeare lifted his speech so directly from Plutarch's account that had they both been alive today, Plutarch could definitely have won a case of plagiarism against him. And the detail is all there. It's the, you know, the golden barge, the purple sails, the clouds of incense, the beautiful half-naked boys and girls, the maidens, the music, the rose petals. And Shakespeare concludes his account of it by saying that Cleopatra pictures Venus. She's done up as Venus, but looking even more beautiful, which in fact is just a slight misunderstanding. Cleopatra, on that occasion, would not have been dressed as Venus. She would have been dressed as Isis, the Egyptian goddess, who was very often identified at the period with the Greek Aphrodite or the Roman Venus, other goddesses of love. And Isis was a goddess of love, but she was also the great mother of her people. And Cleopatra, as queen of Egypt, was, as all the queens of Egypt before her were, the earthly incarnation of Isis. So appearing in an Isis outfit, she wasn't just out to seduce a man, and you know, she wasn't there necessarily to give off a sort of erotic message. She was there as the mother of her people. Isis was a very, very powerful goddess. The sort of cult of Isis in Egypt at the time comes close to a kind of monotheism, and there are sort of hymns to Isis which suggest that she was the creator of all things, the mother of all things, that she controlled the weather, she controlled the seasons, she controlled birth and death. So although, you know, there are other Egyptian deities, Isis was one of the most powerful. So this appearance on the River Cydnus, which has gone down as the beginning of a love story, was actually a very sort of subtly nuanced piece of political theatre designed to tell the whole world that Cleopatra, who'd come there rather at Antony's bidding, came as a powerful monarch, as the controller of a large part of the Eastern world, and she came as more than his equal. You know, he was a mere representative of Rome. She was Egypt. So that's the second of her great spectacles. There are more. But I'll pause there rather than go on about more of them, because that is, of course, the beginning of the famous story, the famous Antony and Cleopatra story, in which Cleopatra appears as the heroine of a love story, which is a part of what she is, of course, but it's that love story tends to rather downplay her other identities as an extremely powerful monarch and a very hardworking and successful one. Now, that story, which you all know, it's the story about a Roman general, a successful, masculine, ambitious Roman general, who meets this dangerously attractive foreign woman, lured off the path of duty, and he forgets everything that he had previously held dear. He forgets his country, he forgets his people, he forgets his marriage, and he becomes the thrall of this seductress. Now, that story, which was largely invented by Octavian and his tame writers. And when I say tame, I'm not talking about a kind of, you know, a public relations office full of kind of hacks, his tame writers included, big names like Virgil, Propertius, Horace, but they all three of those have left sort of overtly propagandist accounts of the Antony and Cleopatra story. And the purpose of that story was simply to discredit Antony, to suggest that he was simply not fit to share power as he had been doing with Octavian, and certainly not fit to take over. And that, on the other hand, Octavian, who was in the terms of the story, the antithesis of Antony, in that Octavian is cool, calm, and collected, and keeps his eyes averted when Cleopatra's in the room, was therefore the perfect Roman and the ideal Roman ruler. It was a very audacious propaganda exercise, but it worked brilliantly, and to such an extent that Antony is kind of erased from the historical record. After the Battle of Actium, after Antony and Cleopatra had been defeated, Octavian was celebrated, as we know from the ancient historians, his terrific victory, not over a Roman rival, but over a foreign aggressor, over an enemy who was Egyptian, a woman, which is a pretty sort of horrific idea, a monarch, which was not a popular thing to be in Rome, where, however spuriously, people still were clinging to republican ideas. So Antony vanishes, and Octavian celebrates his victory over Cleopatra and all her court, which was quintessentially foreign and feminine. In one after another of the sort of ancient historians, we find Cleopatra's court being described as totally dominated by eunuchs and hairdressers. Because, of course, Cleopatra, being a woman, was interested only in party, sex, and hairdressing. And Antony, having come under her spell, also became over-interested in party, sex, and hairdressing, and therefore became a person not worth mentioning. So we have this story in which Cleopatra becomes an irresistible force, someone capable of sort of annulling the greatness of a great Roman hero. And it's successful, this story, in kind of wiping Antony kind of out of the picture. But it also has an unforeseen side effect, which is that in that story, the story only makes sense if Cleopatra is beautiful beyond dreams, is the satisfaction of every possible desire, is the woman for whose sake the world would be well lost. So, as it were, inadvertently, Cleopatra's enemies created her enormous and extraordinary reputation for glamour and charm and beauty and whatever else you might want a woman to have. And that story has been being told and retold over and over again, as I say, for more than two millennia now. And looking at the ways it's changed, and of course it has changed repeatedly, is a very interesting indication of what's been important to the people who were thinking of the story. It changes in all sorts of different ways, but it acts as a kind of litmus paper or a kind of mirror to the sort of developing culture to which we're the inheritors, and showing how that culture's preoccupations and prejudices and fantasies have shifted. So Cleopatra goes from being, her moral status changes. Chaucer in 1380 makes her the first heroine of his Legend of Good Women. And now Chaucer, this isn't really, I think, his sort of consistent line on women, but in that particular poem, he produces a catalogue of good women, and he seems to be working on a definition of female virtue, which is entirely dependent on a woman's willingness to kill herself if abandoned or otherwise left by a man. So people like Dido, or Thisbe, as in Pyramus and Thisbe, and Cleopatra, when their men aren't there anymore, they kill themselves. And this is a very good indication that they are good women, because it means that, unlike most women, they're not immediately plotting to run off with someone else. In other words, for the purposes of Chaucer's poem, the only good woman is a dead one. So, there she is, a model of this rather kind of dismal kind of feminine virtue. But then turn the clock forward several centuries, and we get to Cecil B. DeMille in 1934 contacting Claudette Colbert to ask her to star in his wonderful film, which I strongly recommend to anyone who hasn't seen it. And he asks her, how would you like to play the wickedest woman in history? Now, of course, the only possible answer to that is very much indeed, please, because wicked by the 1930s meant, as it still does in sort of colloquial language, sexy, fun, and, you know, far more fun than the good woman next door. So Cleopatra goes from being, you know, depressingly good to being excitingly wicked. You get that fluctuation, and it goes up and down throughout all the intervening centuries. So she changes morally. She also changes visually throughout most of the Middle Ages, up until the Renaissance, when the sort of recovery of ancient texts began to give people a slightly more nuanced idea of who Cleopatra was and where she came from. But throughout the Middle Ages, she was a famous beauty, and of course, to poets at the time, it was obvious that if she was very beautiful, she must have been blonde. So you have a lot of medieval poets writing about Cleopatra's hair like spun gold, her eyes as blue as the sky, her breasts like ivory billiard balls. And this tradition, even after the Renaissance, actually, I mean, you know, so you know Shakespeare's Cleopatra is described as dark, but there's a wonderful series of frescoes by Tiepolo in the Palazzo Labbia in Venice, where she appears very, very blonde, in a lovely sort of pale pink damask frock, leaving her ivory breasts very much on show, and again in pale blue eyes. And that was the 1780s, am I right? Oh, earlier, 1740s. So that the, you know, the blonde Cleopatra has a life which sort of far exceeds, it extends beyond the point when most people would have known perfectly well that actually she probably didn't look like that, but still, beauty was blonde. And then all of a sudden there's a shift about the time that Napoleon sent his expedition to Egypt, and suddenly Europeans became interested in Egypt in a slightly better informed way than they had previously been. And it became fashionable to have chairs with sort of arms shaped like sphinxes and little obelisks on your mantelpiece, and all things Egyptian came into style. Whereupon Cleopatra suddenly turns brunette, and there's a very gorgeous painting by Delacroix, which is, I think, the first one to show her looking very dark.